Hello and welcome to All Indians Matter. I am Ashraf Engineer. In a constitutional democracy, the courts play an important counter-majoritarian function and serve as a check on the executive. Whenever the executive poses a threat to freedoms, the judiciary is expected to correct the imbalance. This is the very core of its reason to exist. However, it's under challenge now in Modi's India. Trust in the Supreme Court, the last hope of those seeking justice and a preservation of liberties, is eroding. Many think it is failing in its counter-majoritarian function. This is being witnessed through several rulings over the past few years, inaction in some cases, and often what seem to be contradictory utterances. Many believe that the media has already been compromised. If the judiciary doesn't take some self-corrective measures soon, there goes our democracy.
All Indians Matter.
We have on the show Nandini Sundar, Professor of Sociology at the Delhi School of Economics, Delhi University. Her research interests include constitutionalism, academic freedom, democracy, law, inequality, and agrarian ecologies. Her recent publications include The Burning Forest, India's War Against Maoists, which has been translated into several Indian languages, two edited volumes of A Functioning Anarchy, and Reading India, Selections from Economic and Political Weekly, 1991 to 2017. She has written several journal articles on democracy, authoritarianism, and academic freedom. Nandini was awarded the M.N. Srinivas Memorial Prize in 2003, the Infosys Prize for Social Sciences in Social Anthropology in 2010, the Esther Bozerup Prize for Development Research in 2016, and the Malcolm Adisesia Prize for Distinguished Contributions to Development Studies in 2017. Her media articles are available at nandinisundar.blogspot.com. That's nandinisundar.blogspot.com. Welcome, Nandini.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, it's our pleasure. Thanks so much for making the time. Nandini, is the judiciary doing enough to protect citizens' rights?
A short answer is no. People feel really let down by the judiciary, and it's very, very worrying because that was one field where India had really performed quite well internationally, and people looked to the Indian judiciary, you know, and it's really let us down, and it's let sort of jurisprudence across the world down as well.
A legal scholar Anuj Bhuvania wrote, and I quote, "Since Modi's election in 2014, there has been a general sense of disappointment with the Supreme Court. In July last year, Bilal Nazki, former Chief Justice of the Orissa High Court, posted on Twitter, 'It is unfortunate that I have lost faith in an institution to which I owe my existence.'" Nandini, where is the sense of disappointment coming from?
I think the sense of disappointment is coming from at least three things. And, you know, there are many sub-themes within that as well. The first is the blatant double standards that the Supreme Court is displaying. And I'll give an example of that. The second is the court's failure to hear constitutional cases in time. And the third is the sense of disillusionment from the court's clearly flawed reasoning in its effort to bend the law to suit the Modi government, the majoritarian government. So let me give examples of all of these three things. One, the first, the blatant double standards. People saw how Arnab Goswami got bail instantly in 2020, but it took the journalist Siddiq Kappan 2.5 years to get bail for a story which he never even managed to reach to report on. The judges constantly talk about bail being the rule, but they had a special sitting on Saturday to reverse the Bombay High Court order acquitting Dr. Sai Baba, who is 90% disabled. And just 2 days ago, the Supreme Court directed all high courts to decide bail matters expeditiously. But the Supreme Court itself has been sitting on the bail application of Mahesh Raut since September 23, 5 months after the bail, the High Court gave him bail. Mahesh has been in jail since 2018. It'll be nearly 6 years now in June. And this business of high courts allowing stays on their own bail orders to allow the NIA to appeal, knowing that the Supreme Court will sit on it, is an unprecedented development and becomes a way in, you know, of the courts extending incarceration indefinitely. Umar Khalid filed for bail in Supreme Court in April 2023 and has still not had any substantive hearing. So you see that certain people get relief immediately. Certain people are not even charged, leave alone arrested. And other people are denied bail for years on end. The second is something that is, again, very clear for everyone to see, the court's refusal to hear important constitutional cases in time, basically allowing the government to have their way by default and attrition. For instance, the CA judgment, I mean, we are still waiting for a judgment on the CA 370 came after several years. The demonetization judgment by, you know, the courts also admitted that it was academic by the time it happened, but even then they were not willing to rule on process except for one judge. Electoral bonds, we've been waiting since 2018. So basically, the court favors the government by default. And when it does rule, as in 370 or demon, the judgments have invariably gone in favor of the government. And the third cause of disillusionment is the court's flawed reasoning when it has gone in favor of the government. For instance, take Ayodhya, since we're speaking today on a day when, you know, the whole country is officially being forced to celebrate the installation of the Ram idol in Ayodhya. Even though it was a title suit, it was decided in favor of the Hindu faith, and that the same judges who, in their court, in their judgment, allotting the site to the Hindu side, upheld the Places of Worship Act, you now see that they're using convoluted reasoning to try and get around that while hearing the Gyanvyapi case. So it's really, you know, even their judgment in 370 or demon is just kind of goes against a number of accepted conventions and is really worrying because the court seems to be towing the government line on everything.
Yes, absolutely. And but before we proceed, Nandini, to talk about many of those cases that you specifically mentioned, I should point out to listeners that we are recording this on January 22, 2024, which is the very day of the inauguration of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya, as you mentioned. And that Mahesh Raut is one of the accused in the Bhima Koregaon case. And as you mentioned, he's still in jail. So Nandini, now talking about specific cases. In 2018, based on a sealed cover report submitted by the central government and which was not made available to the other side, the court dismissed petitions alleging corruption in procuring the Rafael fighter aircraft. What happened there and what's your view on that ruling?
I think that's another seriously flawed judgment because the petitioners brought a number of irregularities to the court, including in having Anil Ambani as an offset partner without the approval of the Ministry of Defense and without any known prior experience. It's the same as all of these airports being allotted to Adani without any prior experience. So, you know, the other offset partner was Hindustan Aeronautics Limited, which has known experience in this area. So that was a huge scandal in itself. But the court declined to go into the decision-making power process, saying it was beyond its, you know, remit under Article 32. And the same has happened with Adani. So wherever, you know, the courts are being asked to look not into, you know, they're not being asked to judge policymaking per se, but they're being asked to judge flaws in policy making that lead to fundamental losses to the exchequer or have involved criminal wrongdoing. And criminal wrongdoing is very much within the court's ambit, right? And in the case of Adani, the court has asked SEBI to go ahead and has actually turned the investigation onto Hindenburg rather than Adani to see if its report caused a loss to investors. So this is just like the court asking the Gujarat police to file a case against Teesta and RB Srikumar, Teesta Setilwad and RB Srikumar. Because they dared to bring, you know, because Teesta dared to bring litigation to the court. So rather than actually addressing the fundamental questions raised by the petitioners, it's the petitioners who are being put in the dock, whether it's the Adani Sebi thing or it's Teesta. And in the Rafael case, you know, even though the petitioners again asked whether leaked documents could be acceptable as, you know, for in their review petition, the court agreed that leaked documents could be used, you know, in making a petition, but again declined to intervene. So whether you look at this Rafael case or the Adani Sebi case or the Pegasus case or any number of other cases, where there's clearly an attack on fundamental rights or criminal wrongdoing, the court has just said this is not within our purview. And in fact, turned it back onto the petitioners.
And the court has also kept pushing back several important hearings or not ruled decisively, as you said. I mean, you mentioned Umar Khalid, and he's been in jail for what, close to 4 years, I think. And he was charged under UAPA and also for sedition. And that bail hearing has been pending for so long.
Yeah, that bail hearing has been pending since April. He hasn't had any kind of hearing all through 2023. And it's really shocking because Umar is in his recorded speeches for which he is being arrested. He is clearly saying, you know, we believe in love, we believe in the constitution. And if someone like Umar can be arrested for making a speech that is deeply imbued with democracy, the, and, you know, Kapil Mishra, who was clearly inciting mobs against the peaceful protesters in Delhi in 2020, can be, you know, nothing has happened to him. This is a clear case, again, of not just double standards, but of just straightforward abuse of the law. And it's shocking that, you know, Umar has not been getting bail.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the High Court judge as well, you know, when they refused him bail, said, you know, this speech, you know, saying that Modi, you know, saying anything bad, negative about Modi is obnoxious. I mean, you know, in Indian traditions, one can mock even gods. One is constantly, you know, there was always a court jester to keep the king in place. And now we've reached a situation where nobody can say anything at all about the prime minister. You know, it's just really
and
shocking.
The fact that a court judge is saying that you can't, which is really odd. And, you know, I must point out at this stage also Sharjil Imam. I mean, he's been in, the activist has been in jail for, I think, a period now that equals the maximum sentence for which he's for the crime with which he's been charged. So there's absolutely no justification for him being in jail still.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what the Delhi police said in Sharjil Imam's case, they said that he should have not, you know, he quoted Paul Brass on, you know, his thesis is on ethnic riots or something. And he and Paul Brass is a known authority on ethnic riots in UP and, you know, systematic riot manufacturing. And, you know, if you're a self-respecting PhD student working on this, that is the person that you would quote. And the Delhi police is saying, you know, he is being radicalized and by reading all this stuff. And, you know, so is the Delhi police now going to tell us what we should be reading, what PhD students should be writing in their thesis? It's just anything goes. I mean, when you look at the trials of all of these people, all the Bhima Koregaon people or the Sharjil or Umar, just the kind of arguments that the police are making is just has no place in a democracy. For Jyoti Jagtap, again, they're saying, you know, she was, they were talking about how sort of mocking the government or saying, criticizing the government. So if every item of dissent that you, like, you know, any song that you perform that is critical is going to be a case of UAPA, then I think we might as well just shut down, you know, any pretense of being a democracy.
Absolutely. Again, I just point out to listeners that Jyoti Jagtap is an activist cum singer, and she uses her art for her activism. And by the way, also, it's important to point out that the Delhi police, which you mentioned, comes under the central government and not under the Delhi government. Nandini, there's also the electoral bonds case. Now, there is a widespread fear that the anonymity that they allow enables coercion, political favors, corruption. The Supreme Court hasn't ruled from them either, and on them either. And I think the last update was that has asked for electoral bond data from the Election Commission. Now, meanwhile, we've had key state elections and there is a general election coming up.
I mean, the electoral bonds scheme is such a straightforward subversion of democracy. The Association for Democratic Rights, which brings out these excellent reports on, you know, what's happening with electoral bonds and is one of the petitioners in the case, has found that they analyzed the, I mean, I'm just looking at the 2018 to 2021 data that they produced, and subsequently also the figures are much the same. They found that 92.3% of the bonds were in the denomination of 1 crore. And therefore, no ordinary individual is going to purchase an electoral bond of 1 crore. So it has to be corporates, right? And we would want to know, as the taxpaying public, what kind of quid pro quo the government has undertaken in return for these huge donations. And the fact that 95% of the bonds in this period went to the BJP in 2017-18 show again that, you know, there's a clear connection between corporate donations, the ruling regime, and the policies that are undertaken. So it's clearly something that is inimical to democracy, the way that elections are being rigged through an unfair distribution of money in favor of one party. And we all know how expensive it is to fight elections, and the fact that the Supreme Court has just been sitting on this electoral bond case. And as you said, there have been key state elections for which bonds were purchased, and now the general election is coming up, and again, nothing is happening to stop bonds being purchased in that. So the Supreme Court is complicit in skewing the electoral field in a massive way.
Now, many lawyers and former judges have also criticized the Supreme Court for what they say is targeting litigants in a case questioning the clean chit given to Prime Minister Narendra Modi and others in the 2002 Gujarat riots case. Now, the court's judgment was relied on to register a first information report and then arrest activist Teesta Setalwad and former cop R.B. Srikumar. This is for allegedly fabricating evidence about the riots. Could you talk us through that?
I mean, this is both of these judgments, the Zakia Jafri judgment and the Himanshu Kumar versus State of Chhattisgarh judgment, both came in 2022. And both of them are really remarkable because they have targeted the petitioners and demanded that they be arrested for filing PILs. So this is the first time that, actually filing a PIL, and there are lots of frivolous PILs that come to the Supreme Court, which really should be deserved, which deserve to be thrown out immediately. But these are, important cases involving mass human rights violations. And then to say that the very act of coming to the court under Article 32 is a crime really shows the mentality of the court, that it's not interested in justice. It's simply interested in kind of whitewashing the government or the police. So in the Teesta Setalwad case, Zakia Jafri had filed a complaint to the DGP in 2006, naming 63 people, including Narendra Modi, whom she accused of involvement in a larger criminal conspiracy, which resulted in the Gujarat pogroms of February, March 2002. So the judgment by Justice Khanwilkar, Dinesh Maheshwari, and C.T. Ravikumar, and there were three aspects to their judgment. The whole judgment was really aimed at exonerating Prime Minister Modi, then Chief Minister Modi, and to show that, the SIT, which was set up under the former CBI chief, Mr. Raghavan, and which really is quite interesting when you look at the report and the kinds of things that it doesn't deal with, and the way it exonerated Modi, the whole idea was to just praise the SIT, to exonerate Modi and show that he did his best to control violence. Second, to show that even if he and his government failed, it was because the events were beyond them. The Supreme Court actually compares the violence of 2002 to the pandemic. And third, argues that even if there was some failure in controlling violence, it did not amount to a pre-planned conspiracy. So the crime for which they ordered Teesta and R.B. Srikumar to be arrested, the crime, according to the Supreme Court in this whole complaint, was accusing Modi as chief minister of command responsibility for the violence. So it's really, really shocking that rather than deal with any of the facts, they've just turned it back on the petitioner. And they've talked about Zakia Jafri is 83 years old. Her husband was hacked to death in front of them. The whole colony was burnt. So 69 people died. And, she's being, the language that the court uses for her, saying she had the gumption, the audacity to fight her case in the court all these 16 years. And out of those 16 years, I've done a calculation in my article in The Wire of, who was responsible for the various delays in those 16 years that the case was in the Supreme Court. And at least 12 or 14 out of those years were due to Supreme Court caused delays. They were nothing to do with Zakia Jafri trying to delay the case. And even if it takes 16 years to fight your case, whose fault is it? Is it her fault or is it the fault of the legal system? And then to say, to use words like gumption and audacity is such an insult to the very idea of justice, that anybody in this country has a right to justice. You know, this is not something that the courts are giving. They're not like some Raja who is arbitrarily kisi ko ye de diya, kisi ko wo de diya. It's not like a daan that we all have, we as citizens have a right to appeal to our Supreme Court for justice because our constitution gives us that right. So it's just the most kind of horrendous subversion of the idea of the constitution. And the second case that happened that year was the case against Himanshu Kumar for coming along with 9 people from Gompad whose family members had been killed in an attack by the security forces. A little baby had his hand chopped, his fingers chopped off. Women were raped. And then again, they said, you know, how did you have the audacity to, you know, you're really a front for the Naxalites because you're coming with villagers to appeal to the courts. Well, who else will, you know, are the Naxalites appealing to the courts? No. I mean, that's just really, really a kind of shocking stand again. So I think, and then again, we see that in the Sebi and Hindenburg case where the people who, you know, Hindenburg is now, they're supposed to investigate the loss to investors due to the Hindenburg report rather than investigate Adani's fraudulent activities. So I have no words even to describe what these cases amount to, really.
It's a seemingly endless case. I'm just looking at some of my notes and there's so many such cases that we need to talk about. I mean, next one, July 2022, lawyers criticized the Supreme Court for not allowing several first information reports against then BJP leader Nupur Sharma to be clubbed. Now, at the same time, the court said Sharma was, and I'm quoting the court here, single-handedly responsible for what is happening in the country, stop quote. Sharma, as we know, had made derogatory remarks about Prophet Muhammad, which led to violent protests, but also diplomatic friction with Middle Eastern countries. Now, is this one example, in your opinion, of these contradictory utterances?
I mean, there's just, as you said, it's endless. There's Nupur Sharma, there's Kapil Mishra, there's the Wrestling Federation Chief, Brijbhushan Sharan Singh, there's the Chief Minister Biren Singh. I mean, this is like a small sample of the list of known offenders that the Supreme Court has either declined to investigate or they've refused to monitor the investigation. So, for instance, in the Manipur case also, several petitions before the court saying that there needs to be a court-monitored kind of committee to look into. And these are fundamental rights being violated. So entirely within the remit of the Supreme Court, murders, deaths, rapes. They refused to do anything saying we can only, you know, look at relief efforts, etc. It was only when that mass video of women being paraded naked and raped came to light that they then took action, right? So they have nothing. You know, they refuse to monitor or investigate cases which are really open and shut cases of huge, you know, even in the Wrestlers Federation guy, they refuse to, I mean, they just said, we'll only monitor till the FIR is filed. And we all know what has happened. Our wrestlers, who are our national pride, have had to give up their medals, leave wrestling, and the Wrestling Federation just carries on as normal. Brijbhushan carries on as normal. Theni carries on as normal. Everybody. And on the other hand, you know, as we just discussed, FIRs are, the court directs that Teesta should be arrested or that Himanshu Kumar should be arrested. So, you know, this is just one more instance of like blatant double standards and the courts refusing to intervene when it comes to somebody who's associated with the BJP or the RSS. And more than just the lawyers have been talking, not just about FIRs.
The Wrestling Federation, incidentally, has now been suspended by the sports ministry.
Yeah, well, what sort of a step is that?
I mean, I'm not suggesting that's something that's come too late. I think the revelation that the Federation was actually operating out of Brijbhushan's house, which by itself was quite shocking.
Yeah, and fine. I mean, but what has the court done on this, right? I mean, the women, the wrestlers look to the Supreme Court for justice. And I think the courts really failed them.
Nandini, I want to talk about the Babri Masjid judgment too. Now, the court seemed to indicate that the demolition was an illegal act, but that a temple should be allowed anyway at the site in Ayodhya. At the same time, if it was an illegal act, who were the perpetrators and what about bringing them to book?
You know, in 2020, the courts, the Supreme Court should not have heard the title suit before punishing those who were involved in the demolition, right? The very fact that the Ayodhya judgment came in 2019 and the case, the criminal case involving demolition only happened in 2020 was itself a perversion of what should have been the normal sequence, right? Because if the Babri Masjid had not been demolished, the question that needs to be asked is whether the court would still have given the land to the VHP, right? Because there would have been a function, you know, there was a mosque at the site. Would they have been willing to order a demolition of the mosque and then give that land over to the VHP, the RSS? So clearly that illegal act was the basis for being able to give the land to the RSS VHP. When Champat Rai, who, you know, is part of the trust, the Ayodhya Trust, compares January 22nd, 2024, today, to 15th August 1947 as a day of independence, quote unquote, he is not just violating the Constitution because it's the Constitution is founded on independence being something that all communities struggle for. But you also just compare the behavior of the people who were involved in the demolition to our freedom fighters, right? All of our freedom fighters, Nehru, Gandhi, were in jail for several years, right? 9 years for Nehru, 12 years. Bhagat Singh was executed. Now, Bhagat Singh never denied what he had done. You know, he never said that I didn't throw the bomb at the assembly or... whereas Advani and others have, on the one hand, proudly taken credit for demolishing the Babri Masjid, and on the other hand, claiming that they were not part of any conspiracy to demolish the mosque. So they were all acquitted in 2020 on the basis that there was no larger conspiracy and there was not enough proof. Whereas there is so much proof. There's the whole Liberhan Commission. There are various people who testified. And the Supreme Court itself, the Ayodhya judgment, not only did it recognize that the demolition was an illegal act, but then it should have done something to ensure that those who were involved in this illegality were punished. But what is even more worrying today is the fact that the Supreme Court upheld the Places of Worship Act as part of the basic structure. Now, the Places of Worship Act is a really important act. It's a very forward-looking act. And it said... It was passed in 91, a year before the mosque was demolished. And it said that although it made an exception for the Babri Masjid case, which it said, you know, should be mediated through the courts or should be settled through the courts, it said that 1947 will be treated as the date for on which 15th August 1947 will be treated as the date on which all existing places of worship will have their religious character recognized as whatever they were on that date, on 15th August 1947. So if on 15th August 1947 there was a mosque, then it will continue to be a mosque. It will get that protection as a mosque. And if it's a temple that was built illegally over an existing Buddhist shrine, it will continue to be have the status of a temple or whatever status it, you know. And in this country, you know, with our centuries of history, there are innumerable cases of Hindu kings demolishing the temples of other Hindu kings, of Hindu kings demolishing Buddhist shrines and building temples out of that. In fact, the Babri Masjid itself, you know, the so-called structure that the ASI has said it found below the Babri Masjid, could well be a Buddhist monument because, you know, there is evidence of that as well. So, where are you going to draw the line as to what should be restored? And the Supreme Court, in kind of enabling the hearings of Gyan Vyapi and the Shaheed Ga in Mathura, by even though the petitioners have been saying that, you know, even hearing those cases in the lower courts is prohibited under the Places of Worship Act. The Supreme Court has basically gone back on its word. And for this, I hold Justice Chandrachud entirely responsible because he was a member of both the benches of the Ayodhya bench. And he's the one who's been basically giving the green light to Gyanvyapi and Shahi Idga in a kind of ghar vapsi of the temple thing, that these were never mosques. They were actually always temples. And so demolishing the mosque and having the temple instead is just ghar vapsi of a temple. Again, I've written about this in an article on The Wire on why the Places of Worship Act should be preserved. And I would really request everybody to read it and think about how important this act is and how wrong it is to start, you know, demolishing mosques in the name of some restoration.
Nandini, there are several cases, as we've already said, but the last case I wanted to specifically talk about was Article 370. Now, the Supreme Court has recently upheld the action that withdrew Jammu and Kashmir's special status. The court said that it can't be a permanent thing. However, it was part of the constitution and was a promise made to Kashmir at the time of accession. Even the way Article 370 was abrogated was unusual. Now, how does something like this affect confidence in the court?
I mean, the sad fact in Article 370 is that nobody expected any different from this court. Everybody expected the court to rule in favor of the government. And in Kashmir itself, I think people were not expecting anything different. And they really don't have any hope of justice from this court. However, I think everybody was shocked, even though we were expecting a pro-government decision, in the manner of the reasoning. I mean, the reasoning is really shoddy because apart from denying any justice to Jammu and Kashmir, they've actually attacked the basis of federalism all over the country by making this sleight of hand respectable, by saying that an assembly can be dissolved under president's rule, that the parliament can take its place, and that the parliament can then decide whether to dissolve the state itself. So this can actually, in theory, in principle, be applied to any state in this country, right? That you can just be denied your basic rights as a state, which takes away from the fact that India is a union of states. It's not. And the states are important constitutional entities in themselves. They don't derive their rights from the center. They have independent constitutional rights, which is why you have, you know, a state list, a central list, and a concurrent list. And what's interesting both about the 370 judgment and about the Ayodhya judgment is that in going back into some earlier history, the courts completely neglect the immediate history in which an action takes place. So in the Ayodhya judgment, they ignored the whole build-up to the violence that attended the demolition of the Babri Masjid, the Bombay riots in which so many people were killed, the riots all over the country in which people lost their lives, and go back into some kind of ancient history to claim, you know, that it was really the Hindu side which had greater evidence of faith. In the 370 case, again, they completely ignore the way in which the assembly was dissolved, the fact that the government was saying that, you know, we want to try and make a government. They tried to send a fax to the governor. And also the way in which, you know, all the leaders were arrested, journalists were arrested, everybody was arrested. There was a year-long blackout. Habeas corpus cases were not heard. So all of this immediate history surrounding the abrogation of Article 370 finds no mention in the judgment. It's all about, you know, what whether it was a permanent provision or a temporary provision, and going back into their own reading of the constitutional negotiations, which again are deeply contested. So if the judges are so interested in, you know, writing history of a particular order, they should perhaps resign from the courts and become historians and then, you know, try and argue their case. Because if they were with any serious historians, their kind of history would not stand. I'm sorry, but this kind of judicial historical rewriting is not accepted by professional historians because it fails all the tenets of basic history. And it also fails all the basic tenets of judicial reasoning. So these judgments are really quite a travesty.
Nandini, what is your view of former Chief Justice Ranjan Gogoi being nominated to the Rajya Sabha soon after the end of his term?
What is there to think? I mean, what would any right-thinking person think about a judge who hears a case in his own cause on a Saturday, which is a non-working day, in a case where he's accused of sexual harassment, does not sign the judgment, then gets a job as a Rajya Sabha MP with the same government that he favored in the Ayodhya case. And it's interesting also that the person who filed the case against him was reinstated by the Supreme Court a year later. So, you know, the criminal activity that she and her family were accused of by Justice Gogoi in his defense, you know, it's interesting that in that case, Justice Gogoi said that it was part of a conspiracy to defame the court and to make it difficult for the court to do justice. And so an inquiry was ordered against the person who accused him of sexual harassment. So, you know, it's part of a pattern where the tables are turned against anybody who raises their voice or has the courage to file any case in the court. And it takes a huge amount of courage to file a case against the sitting Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, right? So obviously, you know, there had to be some reason for her to do it. And it's shocking that the rest of the judiciary also just went along with this. I mean, by having this bench and the other two judges on this bench.
What about the merits of the case? I mean, what I found really strange was that a judge hearing charges leveled against him. I can't imagine this having happened before, either here or elsewhere. It would have been very, very rare.
I think there are many things happening in the Supreme Court, which a number of very senior lawyers have said have never happened here or anywhere else. You know, the fact that routinely judges, particular judges are being assigned cases, that the Chief Justice's power as master of the roster is surprisingly used only to mark sensitive cases that help the government to particular judges is again something that various senior lawyers have noted. And I mean, there are many kinds of violations of procedure, including the fact that, you know, normally, like if there is a three-judge bench which has decided something, it should, and a kind of similar matter comes up or it goes in challenge, it should be decided by a larger bench, right? But you had Justice Mishra who gave a contradictory judgment against another three-judge bench, sitting as a three-judge bench, and then again marked himself as the person to decide that finally. So it's, I mean, there are all sorts of procedural problems that are happening. And I don't know whether the courts will recover from this under a new dispensation.
What's the sense in academia and the judicial committee about the state of the judiciary now? I mean, is it still seen as truly bipartisan?
I think most people who have been working on the judiciary have flagged concerns. I mean, most independent scholars who have been doing serious research on the judiciary. In terms of being bipartisan, I don't think anyone believes that it's bipartisan. I mean, the judgments have all gone in favor of the government. If you read my article on the Supreme Court in Modi's India, where I've drawn up tables to show how in the last 10 years, all the important judgments have gone in favor of the government. In those few cases where the courts have given us progressive judgments, they've been either weakly implemented or, you know, reversed in subsequent judgments. You know, even if you look at the right to privacy, the Aadhaar judgment kind of reversed, subsequent Aadhaar judgments have reversed that. So I don't think anyone believes that the court is bipartisan.
Nandini, what can the Supreme Court do now to correct this perception? And do you think there is hope for it?
I think the Supreme Court can do a lot to correct the perception. For instance, it can be more transparent about the appointments made by the collegium. Some of those appointments have been quite shocking, like Justice Victoria Gowrie, who has been actually engaged in hate speech against Muslims and Christians. So there's lots. It can go back to convention in terms of marking cases. But I don't know whether the courts will reverse course as long as we have this government. So it's useless for people to look to the courts to save democracy. People have to save democracy themselves through the ballot box. And then, there's a well-known saying that the law follows the election returns. So one can hope that if the government changes, the courts will be less terrified, less compromised, and they will go back to delivering justice.
So Nandini, tell us about your work and what comes next for you.
I'm working on several different things. One is, of course, I continue to be interested in the sociology of law, in particular, the way that the Supreme Court functions. I mentioned that article that I had written on the Supreme Court in Modi's India, which has recently come out in an online journal. It's open access. I'm also looking at academic freedom. There's a whole network of us who are, it's called the India Academic Freedom Network, and we've taken up issues of academic freedom, the censorship in universities, suspension and arrests of faculty and students. And then I'm also doing my own research. It's a biography of Jaipal Singh, former hockey captain and Adivasi leader, member of the Constituent Assembly. So there are several things. And teaching. I go back to teaching.
Nandini, here's a question I ask all my guests at the end of the show. Why do you do this work?
Why do I do my teaching? That's my job. I mean, right now I'm on sabbatical, but... And why do I do research? That's my job and I love it. And this is all part of my academic research.
Yeah, I think the idea is to really find out your core motivation.
But nothing that I've said is not based on my own academic research. So why do you do what you do?
Okay. So. Nandini, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And let's hope that the judiciary gives us some hope in the future.
Thank you all for listening. Please visit allindiansmatter.in, that's allindiansmatter.in, for more columns and audio podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Ashraf Engineer, that's ashrafengineer, and All Indians Count, that's allindianscount. Search for the All Indians Matter page on Facebook. On Instagram, the handle is All Indians Matter. Email me at editor@allindiansmatter.in. Catch you again soon.